Welcome to the Global Research News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman, brought to you by globalresearch.ca. And I'm delighted to have on Daniel Estulin for an important discussion on Daniel's important book, The True Story of the Bilderberg Group. It came out in 2005. It's now updated in a brand new 2009 edition. And Daniel is an award-winning investigative journalist. And for over 14 years, he's researched the Bilderberg Group, its influence on business and finance, global politics, war and peace, control of the world's resources, its money, you name it. This is the most powerful group of people in the world. They get together. Oh, they talk to each other all the time, of course. But they have an annual meeting once a year, this year in mid-May in Greece. And we will talk about Daniel's book. We'll talk about the meeting that just took place. We'll talk about the plans that they have going forward. Oh, there's never unanimity. Things can get a little complicated at times. We have a world economic crisis going on now, so there can be divergent opinions on how to deal with it. Some wanting to be more hardline, some a bit scared. I think everybody ought to be scared. But we'll talk about it all. Daniel, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you so much for having me on your show. I'm delighted.
Oh, I'm delighted to have you on. I really am. This is such an important subject to talk about. The Bilderbergers are the real top-of-the-line movers and shakers of what goes on around the world. And to know what they are talking about, thinking about, have in mind, really is a window into what we can expect going forward. So we want to talk about your book, and we want to talk about the recent meeting. And when you hear music, we have a few breaks that come along, and we'll take those and then come back. But begin, Daniel. Talk about your book and your work for the past 14 years. And I'm curious, why did you decide to do this in the first place all those years back?
Well, that's actually a very good question, again, to start with. This whole Bilderberg journey, when we started back in 1992, because I was born in the Soviet Union, we are white Russians. My great-grandfather was a member of the provisional government, who was Kerensky and Milikov. My grandfather was a colonel of the KGB counterintelligence, but not only KGB counterintelligence, but within the KGB, there was another division in Russian called Vayennaya Kontrarazvedka, military counterintelligence, and within that counterintelligence division, there's another, an even more elite group of people. They didn't have a name, they just had a symbol, it's a bat. Seriously enough, and he was, you know, a member of that elite group within the KGB. And in 1992, he introduced me to a friend of his who was actually a double agent, worked for MI5 and the KGB. And over dinner, he talked to me about the secret society called Bild or something or other. It sounded German to me. As I found out later, it was actually Dutch. I thought it was really strange. He was telling me all these boogeyman stories, which I initially thought were just crazy things, things that were going to happen in the future. And needless to say, I thought most of it was nonsense. I never paid any attention to it until one thing specifically talked about Canada and the time I was living in Canada. But this supposed breakup for you into the future of Quebec, which is a French-speaking part of Canada, from the rest of Canada into the North American Union. Needless to say, again, I didn't pay much attention to until 1995 came, and the separation of Quebec was very much an agenda. And that's when I realized that maybe the world was actually run from behind the curtain.
Okay, let me interrupt, because that music means a break. Let's come back, and we'll continue this. Welcome back to the News Hour. We're on with Daniel Estulin, his book, The True Story of the Bilderberg Group. I don't think we have the best line, so we're calling Daniel back to see if we can get a little better connection. Daniel, are you on yet? No, we're not connected yet. Let me just cover a little bit of what he goes. There are so many strands to this story that we could talk all day about this. It's complicated. It's gone on for many years. The Bilderbergers held their first meeting 55 years ago, 1954, in the Netherlands. They met in secret. They've met in secret every year since then. They don't allow what they do to come out, to be published. And some people who get invited from time to time, people in the media, maybe some select media figures, the media bosses, the important ones, they get more important all the time. The group is composed of a hardcore group of about 80 people. Various others get invited from time to time, depending on their importance for topics that will be addressed at the meeting. Meeting generally runs about 3 days. They certainly don't publicize it, that's for sure. But different people get invited, and I would suggest, imagine any important person, really important person you can think of in the U.S., in the Western European countries, the important Asian ones, and selected other countries around the world, important people. They show up at Bilderberg groups, at Bilderberg group meetings, to talk about the things that are on the agenda. Always the most important things. Danny, are we connected?
Yeah, I'm here.
Oh, I'm just giving a brief overview to let listeners know what they may not be familiar with, and then I'll let you pick up the story. So what you wrote in your book, Daniel, their idea overall, and we'll let you talk about what they discussed at this last meeting. We won't go into how you found it out. You have your sources. I have no idea how you developed them, but you did. And it's important that we just don't talk too much about that. But overall, their idea is for a one-world state of affairs, a one-world government. Daniel, I believe, refers to it as a world company, a single global marketplace policed by one world army, most likely NATO. And their idea is a universal set of values, centralized control of world populations. And the way you do that easily is by mind control. It's a lot harder to do it when you have to bring the troops out in the streets and club people or shoot people or do the things that the military does so well. It's a lot easier if you could just manipulate their minds and get them to go along with what you want to do. And they're very clever about that. The most common tactic is to scare people, make them believe that your policies are really intended to help them. Of course, the truth is that the policies are intended to hurt them so the Bilderbergers can help themselves. So they manufacture crises. They manufacture conflicts. We seem to have a state of perpetual wars. It's a very ugly kind of thing. Daniel, I have one question, then I'll let you get back into the story. After 14 years, how have you managed to stay safe and not get locked into their sites for elimination? Any idea about that?
Well, I think it's just simply the numbers game. I've sold over 2 million copies of my book in 67 countries, which is now being going to be translated into 48 languages and 5 continents. You know, but again, it's 2 million is considerable number of books. But then, if you consider that 1 billion people watch the Oscars, or 350 million Americans and Europeans and Asians watch the final of the Super Bowl, you know, 500 million. I don't know what the numbers are. You know, again, 2 million is a pivotal number, which really doesn't affect. And unfortunately, again, the media, the mainstream media, has had a very important role to play, not necessarily in stuffing, you know, what I have to say, but brainwashing people into believing that what they see on television or what they read on the cover of the New York Times and the Washington Post and Time Magazine and Newsweek is it, because, again, what they have done is they made people laugh in your face when you tell them that the reality is quite different from what they see on the nightly news broadcast on the cover of New York Times, because their response and reply is very simple: is if that's the case, then why is it not on the cover of the New York Times? Because, again, the mainstream media form part of the world elite, and again, the people who attend Bilderberger meetings, annual meetings, very much, you know, the creme de la creme of the American and the world media, the New York Times, Washington Post, Time Magazine, Wall Street Journal, Le Monde from France, Google Pisa from Spain, you have the Financial Times and the Wall Street Journal and the Economist and other leading publications the world over are there, which is, again, one of the reasons we do not hear anything about Bilderberg in the mainstream press, because they're sworn to secrecy. And one of the first rules of engagement when the meetings begin or before the deliberations begin is everyone is told that the information revealed at Bilderberg is not to be released to the public.
Oh, indeed. You had some wonderful quotes in your book. You had one that, a number stick out for me, but one of the ones you had was from a man named Richard Salant. He was the head of CBS News back in the 1960s, and his quote went something to the effect, I mentioned it on the program before, his quote was that we give listeners or viewers not what they want, but what we want them to have. And that was in the 1960s. I mean, we had the Great Society then. We had a few good social programs. We got Medicare back in those years. We also had the Vietnam War, the horror of that. But that was then. So just imagine the way things are now. And the media is so much more greatly concentrated today than it was back then. Back then there was no cable TV. You talk about the nightly news, Daniel. I think a better term would be to call it the nightly non-news, because they certainly don't tell you what's going on. They tell you what they want you to think is going on. And you also had a wonderful quote from Henry Kissinger, where he talked about, it was a long quote and I don't have it in front of me, but that these people, through mind control, can create a state of fear in the minds of the public. That I think he started off saying, if troops went into Los Angeles, people would have a fit. But if you can scare people enough to think there really is something awful going on, then they will practically beg you to bring the troops into the streets to protect them. And his prediction.
Henry Kissinger back in that was Henry Kissinger saying back in the early 1990s, and the country, his voice was recorded by one of the Swiss attendees to the meeting, and it was later released for public consumption. And is this exactly what he said? Absolutely.
Well, it's true, because every time they want to do something that is just awful, the most recent one, Daniel, go back to the 9/11 event. I mean, if anybody thinks it happened the way we were told about it in the media, they're dreaming. I don't think listeners to this program believe that. I certainly don't. We've yet to learn the full story. We may never learn it all, but it certainly wasn't the way it was portrayed. But the whole world changed on that date. They could not possibly get through the policies they enacted on September 10th. But on September 11th, they could do anything they wanted. They literally could strip away the Bill of Rights of the U.S. Constitution, three or four of the amendments, and enact these horrible laws that desecrated civil liberties. And they keep doing it. They continued with one after another. And I've written a number of times about it. And now they want to get this horrible Lisbon Treaty enacted in Europe, which one or two or more countries object to. And the Lisbon Treaty, there'll be militarization with it once people catch on to what they really want, but it's the most extreme neoliberal agenda, where corporations make out like the bandits they are, Daniel, and the people in plain simple English get screwed. That's what this Lisbon Treaty is all about. Well, Ireland shot it down before. Didn't the Netherlands shoot it down as well?
Well, the Netherlands and the French, and I was actually on the front lines in the Netherlands fighting for to make sure that, you know, for people's hearts and minds that we won that war in France and in the Netherlands. They just came back and you know, with a watered down version, or so they say, and of course it was passed. And in a country such as Germany and a few others, where they actually were very, very much concerned that people would vote it down, they just took the voting rights out of people's hands and put it into the parliament, and of course most of the parliamentarians and politicians voted for the treaty, and now we're down to our last strike, which is Ireland. And Gannon, this is the man who was actually shot it down the last time around using his considerable capital, and is added again. And one of the key issues of this year's Bilderberg meeting, they were looking at ways to actually shut him down by discrediting him. A lot of the ways the Bilderbergers are thinking of doing it is using a whispering campaign, as they call it in the United States mainstream media, claiming that Gandhi gets his monies and finances through the extreme right-wing American parties and American militia, which, of course, I don't think they're going to have much luck with it. And although the polls in Ireland are saying that the people most likely will vote for the Lisbon Treaty, we're getting a different signals from the politicians and and our sources in Ireland. Most likely they're going to vote it down the way things stand right now.
What they really do, Daniel, is the aims they have don't change. They do not change. They're very clever at disguising the language to make people think that this is a kinder, gentler version of what they came out with before. But absolutely, the aims are as hardline, and I certainly hope it doesn't pass, but who knows? And if it gets defeated, they'll just come back and try it again.
This is RVN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to the News Hour. On with Daniel Estulin, talking about the Bilderberg Group. Daniel, shall we talk about the big stuff that they discussed in mid-May? In your early insights into what they plan to talk about, you mentioned and you wrote about the fact that there was a debate, a pre-meeting debate, about whether to have a very, very nasty, protracted depression, or maybe just have a shorter one lasting a couple of years. But the word depression with a D, like in David, was on the agenda. And apparently there are some people very scared about this. Any insights into what they plan to do ahead? I think everybody wants to know that.
Yeah, very much so. I was just wondering during the break if it makes sense if I explain. But one of the things about the Bilderberg is what people don't exactly understand. And how is it all these people actually able to work together? Why the royal houses form such an important part of what is the Bilderberg in a circle? And how all these corporations seem to interlock amongst each other, and why there has never been any real leaks from any of the Bilderberg meetings over the past 55 years. So we can talk about, obviously, about the conclusions of the Bilderberg meeting, but I also thought that it might be interesting for people to understand how all these key elements, the corporations and the royalty, how all they fit together into this, you know, to this juggernaut. I don't know. What do you think?
Oh, well, I think everybody wants to hear the insights that you have and going in any direction that you think is most important to go in.
Well, let's have a look at the some of the things that they talked about at the meeting. It looks like there are serious disagreements within the hardcore group on the best ways to loot the planet there. Again, within what I've seen from the 73-page Bilderberg report that I have received from my sources, and reading is very carefully between the lines because, again, unfortunately, what they do with the eye on posterity, they don't actually name names, as most criminals would want their name to be named as some of the things that they're plotting and planning to do to us. What they say is an American gentleman from the State Department or a European banker said so-and-so. So based on this information, what I've been able to glean from my sources and by process of elimination, I can tell you that this year's meeting was unique in the sense that you had two groups, both hardliners, but with two very different ways of understanding how the planet should be looted. The one group of the hardliners, led by such people as Henry Kissinger, they're very much for the dramatic decline and severe short-term depression, which is a year and a half. And also there are those who think that things have gone too far, and the fallout from the global cataclysm couldn't be accurately calculated if Kissinger's and others' model is chosen. Now, amongst them, well, the second group is Richard Holbrooke. What is unknown at this point, because, again, I haven't seen it in the Bilderberg report, is if Holbrooke's point of view is, in fact, that of Barack Obama's point of view. Now, Bilderberg has dealt a blow to those in the group who were hoping for some sort of an economic revival, agreeing that the recession will be deeper and the road to recovery longer and harder than the happy talk coming from the world leaders. The terms used were, and I quote, relatively slow and protracted, end quote. Now, if you pay attention to the press dailies, you will see quite a bit of these two phrases in the weeks and months to come. On a different note, some of those who attended this year's conference will give the opposite, more moderate view, stating that, again, I quote, the economy requires a period of healing and that it will take time, end of quote. Now, while you will hear these two contrarian points of view in the press from two Bilderberger camps, both will pay heed to the idea of, again, I quote, great uncertainty over the outlook. Now, over the next several months, they will deliberately refuse, by they I mean the Bilderberger attendees, to comment or to commit to any specifics, simply pointing out, again, quoting, that there exists big risks to recovery, still reeling from financial turmoil, making it very difficult to assess developments, end quote. However, some leading European bankers, faced with the specter of their own financial mortality, unsurprisingly are extremely concerned, calling this high wire act, I quote, unsustainable. This is in the Bilderberg report, saying that U.S. budget and trade deficits could result in the demise of the dollar. Now, recent fears about their own survival have not been quelled because, as one Bilderberger pointed out, and again, unfortunately, I don't have names because no names are ever mentioned. Again, I quote, the banks themselves don't know the answer to when meaning when things will get better. I'll agree, however, that the level of capital needed for the American banks may be considerably higher than the government suggesting through their infamous stress tests.
When they talk about uncertainties, Daniel, oh my goodness, we can go in lots of directions on that. Any idea what they really mean most by that term? What are we worried about? That the economy might literally collapse under their feet?
Well, absolutely. Again, they're looking at, in a nutshell, they're looking at a year, year and a half. Before the meeting, in the pre-meeting booklet, which I had access to, they're looking at two scenarios. One, a considerably long, stagnation, or a short and very deep depression, and they decide short and deep because, again, when you take something long-term, they just simply couldn't calculate because we're looking at 2014, 2015, and that, I think, simply is a little bit too far for them at this point in time. So they decided on a short and obviously a very deep recession. Now, I think extrapolating it, it also affects the future of the U.S. dollar and the U.S. economy. And as I said before, the plan is for the Bilderberger group through their allies in Washington and Wall Street to continue to deceive millions of savers who believe the hype about the supposed upturn in the economy.
Danny, let's stop there. We need to break away.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back to the NewsHour. On with Daniel Estulin, talking about his book, The True Story of the Bilderberg Group, and the annual important meeting that just took place in mid-May, so just a couple of weeks ago. So, Daniel, I guess they're still, debating, giving thought to just exactly how mean and nasty or not so mean and nasty they want to be over the months to come, or do you think they're coming close to making a decision on that?
Well, I think that it's official. Official, obviously, from their point of view, and not for the public consumption. Still, the way Bilderberger meetings work, what happens is that you have 120 people who do not sit in the room together. What they do is they break up into six groups, all of them discussing the same point, and all of them looking at it from different points of view. There's a panel leading the discussion of three or five people, and the rest are participating. There are no citizens. Everybody has to say something. If you don't participate, you're never invited back. And what basically they do, no one tells anybody what to do. That's very important to understand. If you read conspiracy in the internet sites, you know, it seems like, you know, there's this really bad guy who's ahead of all these other people and tells everyone what to do. It doesn't work like that. No one tells anyone what to do. What they do is they work through consensus. You have a core group of people who are very much pro a certain point of view, which has been hashed and rehashed and discussed before the meetings even begin, which is why you have the pre-meeting booklets, which I handed out to the attendees. They pretty much know which direction they want to go, and what they need is a consensus of everyone involved on the best way to get there. And what they do is, again, the meetings themselves serve as a way to getting everyone on board. And after the meetings are done, the hardcore, which would be the Rockefellers and the Etienne Davignon, who is the president of the Bilderbergers, and you have the European Steering Committee and the American delegates on the Steering Committee, they would sit down and actually work it out in a way that the lesser and the less important attendees wouldn't know anything about, because, again, out of the 120 who attend annually, 50 or 60 of them pretty much come every single year. Some, like Rockefeller, they've been coming for generations since the very first meeting. Others have come, you know, on and off for the past 25, 30 years, and still yet others are invited once or twice. And needless to say, these individuals have no idea at all that there's a very organized structure behind Bilderberg and Eastern. So, yes, what you're saying is that the discussions are still ongoing, but they pretty much know which direction they're going. It's just a matter of ironing out all the minute details. What I'd like to do is, we've touched on so many things, and we've already done about half an hour, Stephen. I'd just like to sum up a couple of the things we talked about. We never really got anywhere very, very far. Is that okay with you?
Oh, absolutely. Let me just make one comment. Certainly for the past half century, if you could single out one person above all the others with more influence, more power, it probably would be David Rockefeller, the patriarch. Current patriarch of the Rockefeller family. He's not a young man anymore. A week from this Friday, he'll be 94 years old. Now, I guess he's still active, but I doubt he's the same David Rockefeller he was 10 or 20 years ago. So sooner or later, he will pass from the scene. But I think even now, he is the man to be reckoned with.
Well, you know, yes and no. Again, for public consumption, when people talk about Bilderbergers and secret societies, you know, the two boogeymen are the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds. Although it's not really that simple. I mean, this is just the visible front, because, you know, what they call the Bilderberg Group or the Bilderberg Club is only 55 years young, and in human, you know, history terms, is very, very little. So how can a group as powerful as Bilderberg be so young? Well, in fact, they're not. I found references to, you know, their roots. I spent enough years researching today's Bilderberg Group in the National Library in Florence, one of the three most important centers for this type of research, along with the British Museum and the National Archives in the United States. And I can tell you, you know, with paperwork in hand, that what today called the Bilderberg Group, 800 years ago, had another name. It was called the Venetian Black Nobility. And these are the people behind the throne, the Bilderberg throne or whichever throne. So the fact that most people know who David Rockefeller is, and the fact that most people are aware of family by the name of the Rothschild, this qualifies them from being very, very powerful. I can tell you that the most powerful families who are behind the Bilderberg Group are the Venetian Black Nobility, and probably the most powerful family amongst all of them is old Italian nobles by the name of Frescobaldi's and the Savoys. And the Savoy, of course, most people know who they are just because there's a hotel called the Savoy Hotel. But the Frescobaldi's, very, very few people are aware who they are. And this is where the real wealth lies. When I say wealth, I don't mean millions of dollars or billions of dollars, as, you know, Time Magazine or Forbes calls the, you know, 100 wealthiest men in the world. I'm talking about real money that is measured in trillions and in quadrillions of dollars. Yes, I said quadrillions. I have one document at home, which is an extract of one bank account of the Krupp family, K-R-U-P-P. These are the old German industrialists. And this one extract from one bank account has $112 trillion in it. Now, you and I have more than one bank account, and although we may only have $10 in it, we have more than one. I imagine these individuals also have more than one. And if they have $112 trillion in one account, I can only imagine how much money they have in another account. So, again, the real money is measured in trillions and in quadrillions of dollars. So these are very, very old money, because Rockefeller's new money is 150 years worth of wealth, and the Rothschilds, 250 years. I'm talking about wealth going back about 1,000 years. That's real wealth, and these are the real wheelers and dealers behind the public facade and the faces, such as the Bilderbergers, of course, people in power, and I mean people who are in real power. They will go out of their way to make sure we are perpetually misled and manipulated, because, again, the majority's perception of reality, especially in political arena, is not our own. It is shrewdly manipulated and imposed upon us by the men behind the curtain. And, you know, when you're talking about 9/11, obviously that's one very, very clear example, because, again, people who try to create empires do it by manipulating the people they try to conquer, and that's one of the reasons, again, everyone knows about the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds and the boogeyman that is supposedly Bilderberg. But again, it's just a front. Organizations are more powerful than the Bilderberg group, and one of them is the Venetian black nobility.
Oh, I think that's very important, Daniel. And of course, you're talking about, to a large extent, an aristocracy that just continues its reign from one generation to the next, going back many hundreds, maybe 1,000 or more years. And over that period of time, if you're talking about people of such importance, they can accumulate wealth, as you suggest, of unimaginable amounts. And I'm sure a lot of their wealth is not in, alone in currencies. I mean, they may have $1 trillion in one bank. Heaven help that bank if they would draw it and shift to another bank. But they probably own the bank. With that kind of wealth in a bank, they certainly control it if they don't own it. But they have to have a lot of gold, silver, other precious commodities.
You just touched on something very, very important. You said aristocracy. That's exactly what they are. You see, the idea behind each and every Bilderberg meeting is to create what they themselves call the aristocracy of purpose between European and North American elites on the best way to manage the planet. In other words, the creation of a global network of giant cartels more powerful than any nation on Earth, destined to control the necessities of life of the rest of humanity. It's a very dynamic system in that it changes with the times. It absorbs and creates new parts while excreting the remains of the decaying parts, being the Lehman Brothers, be it Enron, be it Russell Anderson. Our members come and go, but the system itself, it has not changed in over 800 years. It is a self-perpetuating system, a virtual spider web of interlocked financial, political, economic, and industry interests with the Venetian ultramontane fondue model at the center. And one of the things about Bilderberg that most people don't understand, and again, that's why I guess they call them the conspiracy theorists or theorists, is how do all these people work together. Now, I believe it was back in 2005, Etienne Davignon, who's the president of the Bilderberg Group, the BBC asked him about my book and my declarations and public declarations about what they do. And he basically said that, you know, this is crazy what Mr. Estrin is saying. He says, business influences society and politics influences society. That's purely common sense. That's one of the reasons why these people come together. But again, I can show you very easily that it's not the case. That's not how it works. There's actually a much more sinister reason for all these people being together, because, again, it's the aristocracy of purpose between the same people who have ruled the planet for the past 800 years.
Andy, one important thought that was in your book that really hits anybody reading it and digesting it between the eyes, that what it all comes down to with these people, I mean, they want global control, they want a one world government, but I believe you used the idea that they want a world composed of two groups, rulers and serfs. They want to end the middle class. And, of course, the idea of democracy is just ludicrous in their mind. Obviously, they want no democracy, maybe an illusion of democracy, but certainly not the real thing. But just imagine a world of only rulers, which is a tiny sliver of the world population, and everybody else, workers, serfs, with basically no rights, and militarized to see to it that anybody gets out of line, they're simply eliminated.
You see, again, this is very easy to explain historically. One of the reasons the New York Times is and the Washington Post never come anywhere near me, because I could destroy any argument they actually put up against me, because I'm not a conspiracy nut. I don't look like one. I don't dress like one. I certainly don't talk like one, and I really know my history. See, what you're talking about, and the reason, again, the owners and the serfs, the oligarchs and the people who work for them, it's actually a very old concept. The concept is, which is what Bilderberg is really all about, and the Venetian black nobility is all about for the past 600 years, is the utter contempt and intent on their part to destroy what is known as the nation-state republic. Now, modern history superseded medieval history. At that moment, that the institutions which singularly distinguish modern from medieval history put into place, and that development occurred at the point where Patriarch Isidore and other representatives of the Eastern Church convened at the Council in Florence back in 1439, and in 1439, that was the beginning, the impetus given to the creation of nation-state republics, and the first one was, of course, in France with Louis XI, and then in England with Henry VII. And basically what we've had, for the first time in history, thanks to the concept of nation-states, race-state republics, we've had constitution laid in the United States, we had natural law, social welfare, where for the first time in history, we the people stopped being slaves and started working for ourselves. That was the first condition of nation-state republics. And the second, scientific and technological progress as a mandate given to the republic. Now, these two ideas represented a crucial argument. Their existence as institutions in any part of Europe changed everything in all of the Europe, because these changes increased the rate of development of per capita and per square kilometer power of mankind over nature. And this is what is behind this ferocious conflict of the past 650 years between the forces representing classical culture, which is on our side, our people, from Solon to Socrates to Plato, Leonardo da Vinci, Raphael, Leibniz, Schiller, against the forces representing Venetian-led Enlightenment movement represented throughout history by such individuals as Bertrand Russell and, of course, the supine levels of the Bilderberg group.
Oh, it's a very, very frightening situation that you think about this, and you realize that these people, they might be very nice if you met them one-on-one and had no idea what they were up to, but this is very nasty stuff where mass humanity, they simply want total control over it, including eliminating a large portion of the global population they think is excessive, extraneous, and they don't want these people using resources that they want directed in a different direction for themselves or whoever they want to get it. But they want to eliminate a very sizable chunk of the global population.
Well, again, you know, again, historically, if you understand what they're doing, you can explain it away, which is why, again, it's very, very difficult to write me up as a conspiracy nut, because, again, I know my history, so I'm not a conspiracy nut. You see, we are right now at a 6.7 billion people plateau. We can actually go one of two ways. We can actually increase the population base to about 10 billion people, so that would be the next plateau, or we can actually go down to about two, which would be, of course, the desired result based on World Wildlife Fund predictions and hope. And if you analyze how and why they're doing this, again, it all goes back to the background, which is energy. Now, there are two energy resources in the world. One is the nuclear energy, which is the best, the cheapest, the longest lasting, and needless to say, the something which will allow us to increase the population base to 10 billion people, something that Bilderbergers and their cohorts do not want. And the other one, of course, is using any other energy resources, and oil, of course, is one of them, because as we're running out of oil, we only have very few years left of oil reserves. And as we run out, what we're doing, what they're doing right now to the world, again, makes perfect sense. If you can actually destroy the demand and take money out of people's hands, what basically you're doing is saving the energy reserves for the wealthy people, for the world's most powerful. Because again, to make anything, to anything you we have, we touch, we eat, is done through oil at this point in time. And As we are running out of oil, the only way to preserve the oil reserves is, again, to destroy the demand. This is something that I saw in one of the Bilderberger reports back in 1995, I believe. I saw a phrase literally was demand destruction. I asked a friend of mine years later, an important man from one of the world banking institutions, to explain it to me. He said, how do you destroy demand? I said, well, war is a very good way of doing it. He said, no, it's much easier than that. You destroy the demand by destroying the world economy. That was back in 1995, as I will say this again in the report. And this is what we're seeing right now. By destroying the world economy, you take money out of people's hands. This is what's behind the 1929 supposed Great Depression, which wasn't really a Great Depression. It was simply a transfer of wealth. We, the people, lost our equity, our money, our homes. And somebody came along and bought it all up for pennies on the dollar. And, of course, people with money are always the same corporations and companies who, strangely or not so strangely enough, all belong to the same secret societies with, you know, the building of it being the central mall.
Well, apparently the same thing is going on again today. We're certainly going through the gravest economic crisis since the 1930s. And this gives these people a golden opportunity. Crash assets, crash financial assets of all kinds. And then these people with enormous resources can come in and scoop them up for a fraction of what their true value really will be. And of course, we help the big banks out, Daniel, by handing them trillions of our dollars so they can consolidate and become much more powerful. Again, very, very ugly stuff. Oh, we've got another break. We've got another break, Daniel. When we come back, maybe you can hit on what you think are the most important things we need to wrap up in a few minutes. But we'll take another break, and we'll come right back.
This is RVN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to the News Hour, back with Daniel Estulin. Daniel, we've got a few minutes left, and whatever you think is most important that we have not discussed, take the time and let listeners be aware of those things. I think it's awfully important. Go ahead.
Well, I think something that's often overlooked when people talk about Bilderberg and secret societies, how are all these people working together? Why it is so difficult to actually defeat them? Why, you know, we're always at a loss of how to do this, because all of them, again, are interlocked, and it's so hard, you know, to actually unravel them. But so let me just give you an example. An example I want to give you is the Royal Dutch Shell, of course, which is a product of a union between British and Dutch petroleum interests. Now, Royal Dutch Shell, World War II chief, Henry de Heterogene, was a notorious backer of Hitler, and RDS's banker, Lazard, of course, the very well representative of Bilderberg, but such people like Vernon Jordan, a dear friend to Bill Clinton, they created this bank called Bank Worms, out of the Shell-connected transport company. Worms, though, of course, the Vichy regime supporters, and the Vichys were the de facto rulers of France on behalf of Hitler. And, of course, Royal Dutch Shell, they funded cultural warfare operations against the United States and the rest of the world, including the creation of the environmentalist movement and creation such as organizations such as Greenpeace. Now, Royal Dutch Shell, they have interlocking directorate with ING, which is a Dutch company, ExxonMobil, which is another Dutch company, a chemical company, Unilever, Rio Tinto, Boeing, Lloyds Bank, UBS, and AXA, which is one of the biggest insurance companies in the world. And, of course, they're in turn interlocked with the British Petroleum. That's what World Dutch Shell is, which is again a product of British and the Dutch petroleum interests. And BP, board of directors is Royal Bank of Scotland, Roche, Goldman Sachs, Rolls-Royce, General Electric, Bank of America, KPMG, GlaxoSmithKline. And so you see all these corporations are interlocked with each other and to each other. And again, they're always working together towards a common objective. And that objective, as I said a few minutes ago, is the aristocracy of purpose between the North American and the European elite on the best ways to rule the planet, obviously, supposedly for our benefit, but I doubt it very, very much. It's obviously at our expense.
Well, very much at our expense. Again, I think listeners to this program certainly are well aware of that. These people mean us no good. And everything going on didn't happen by chance. It was planned. It was intended. These people have their own goals. And it concerns everybody listening to this program for sure, Daniel. Just exactly what can they look forward to ahead? We have all kinds of headlines now talking about recovery is on the way, and we've had this colossal stock market rally. People that I pay attention to and have on this program think the real facts are exactly the opposite. And there's an extended period of hard times to come. Now maybe that's exactly what the Bilderbergers want.
That is exactly what the Bilderbergers want. My one advice to the people listening to the show is understand how money works. I think it's probably the best advice I can give others. This is advice I was given by several people who are very, very high up and also who are members of the Bilderberger Inner Circle, who actually are more than helping us fight this war from within. Their advice is understand how money works and help explain it to others, and how only through money we can win this war, because obviously we have no army, we have no intelligence, we have no ways of hurting these people other than through financial debacle, which is how exactly one of the reasons they're planning to take money out of our hands, because as long as
Daniel, I'm going to cut you off because we're just about to break away to the next program. The only thing we have is our own common sense, and we have numbers. They have lots of divisions. We have lots of numbers, and we somehow have to use them in our own self-defense. This was a great hour, Daniel. I hope we could do it again sometime.
Thank you
so much, Daniel. And join us again tomorrow for another important discussion. James Petras on tomorrow. Join us then.